From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
So the other day, as I was plotting who I could ask for help outsmarting the coming season's cabbage worms and coaxing the Brussels sprouts to fatten up on time for holiday meals, I got an email from organic seed farmer and breeder Don Tipping of Siskiyou Seeds in Oregon. You might remember Don from his last visit to the program when he taught me how to grow onions like a pro from seed, one of the most popular subjects ever on my show and website. Apparently, Don had somehow heard what was on my mind because he wrote to suggest a conversation about what he calls brassica success tips. Serendipity. So see, yes, sometimes you do get what you wish for. Now, before we meet Don with the next episode in my annual seed series, first, these messages.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com. Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/awaytogarden.
Don Tipping has been growing and selling wholesale seed on his farm called Seven Seeds for about 20 years, and in 2009 started a retail seed company as well, Siskiyou Seeds, offering his own seed and also the best varieties from a number of organic seed farming friends. Don also hosts a five-day seed academy each spring, teaching farmers, gardeners, and others to have success with seed, breeding, propagating, growing, harvesting, and saving. He's here today to talk about those promised brassica success tips he knows I'm longing for, and I welcome Don Tipping back to Way to Garden. Hi, Don. How are you?
Hi, Margaret. I'm doing well. Thank you.
It's so nice that you could read my mind. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Great minds think alike about brassicas, right?
Yeah.
It looks like from your updated new website and all the new offerings, like there's a whole selection of organic flower seeds, I think, that are a specialty of your partner. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. My partner, Stacy, has been a farmer florist for about a decade, mm-hmm. and I invited her to, you know, let her love of flowers shine through in terms of our seed offerings. As we've always grown a lot of flowers on our farm for pollinator habitat,
yes.
and just the beauty that they bring, but there's quite a resurgence in the desire to grow organic local flowers. So that whole concept around local food is extending to flowers, and we wanted to be able to support that by having the choice varieties that farmer florists are looking for.
Yeah, so. and gardeners. And gardeners,
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
Well, good. So we'll talk about some other things that are new to the website later on in the program, but I want to get right down to the promised brassica success tips. Because between timing and pest control, I know a lot of us gardeners really need the advice. So let's get right down to the promised brassica success tips. Because between timing and pest control, I know a lot of us gardeners need your advice. So first, the word brassica, and some people say crucifer or mustard family, it's a lot of different things that we grow, isn't it? It's not just broccoli or anything. Like it's mustards,
yeah,
and yeah.
It's a huge family,
yeah.
That includes everything from radishes and rutabagas to broccoli, cauliflower, collards, kohlrabi, and then a lot of oddballs too, that like arugula that we may not normally associate with being a brassica.
Yeah. I think even horseradish is in the family, and you can kind of tell when it flowers, it looks a little bit alike, doesn't it?
Yeah, that, and another one that would be like that is Persian cress.
Oh, I don't know that.
That has, some people call it penny cress because the seed pods look like little coins.
Oh, neat. So now you grow, there's, in some of these there are hybrids and open pollinated varieties, but you grow open pollinated varieties, yes?
Correct, yeah. Everything we offer and that we grow for seed on our farm is all open pollinated, which for me has been a bit of an intentional choice, because then anyone who wants to can actually save seed from what they get from us.
Mm-hmm.
And I really just believe in that whole idea of being open pollinated as a business model and just for my own self.
Right, ethically, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some of the brassicas seem really easy to grow, like to just direct sow almost. I mean, I'm speaking as a home gardener, not as a farmer and seed breeder, but like arugula or radishes or even the mustards. You know, I feel like I can practically treat them as I do salad, other salad-y sort of things, and you know, almost just direct sow them. But sometimes I get like flea beetles and other things that give me problems. Is that a problem out there too? You're in Oregon, yes.
Yeah. Well, and I think to take just a little step back and look at the brassica family as a whole, of, you know, we know through the recent popularity of kale,
yes,
in terms of people using in green drinks and just as adding to their diet more than
right.
perhaps they did a decade ago, that the whole brassica family has a lot of nutrition. Well,
yes.
that nutrition comes from the soil, obviously, but it also makes it a bit of a target for pest insects. Everything from slugs to, you mentioned, flea beetles and cabbage moths
mm-hmm.
and cutworms, and you name it, because it's there's a lot of bang for your buck, so to speak, in that eating those plants. And they don't have a lot of the defenses that some other plants may have to make them unpalatable or uninteresting to pests. So, you know, as a gardener, you have to consider that and take measures to avert damage so you can get a crop. Organically.
Right.
And, you know, for us, like flea beetles, you mentioned, one
yeah.
of the things we've had to do is use floating row covers, and we found that could be really effective.
Yes.
The spun polyester, if people aren't familiar with
yeah.
that.
And so now, do you put that on when you sow seed, before it even emerges, or what? When do you put down the cover?
Well, we've noticed there's different approaches you can take. Some of the mustards, like the Brassica rapa, that include tatsoi and mitsuna, Chinese cabbage, napa cabbage, and turnips, actually, they're what I find the most attractive to flea beetles because they're the most tender. They don't have any of the spicy compounds.
Mm-hmm.
So when we grow that as like a salad mix crop, we'll seed it, direct sow in the and right in the ground, and then cover it right away.
Yes.
Because if you let the flea beetles build up a population, it's really difficult to do something about it. And they don't seem to have many natural predators.
No, they're real tough here, too. Yeah.
Yeah, whereas I found the brassicas that have that more waxy coating, like broccoli or cabbage, in general, that would be the Brassica oleraceae crops, they tend to, once they get up and going, they can resist predation by pests better than
okay.
the more tender ones.
Okay.
So. But even still, when we've grown like kale, we've had, you know, significant flea beetles. And for folks that aren't familiar with that, it can just riddle the leaves with all these tiny pockmarked holes.
Yeah. It's still safe to eat, folks, but it doesn't look too good if you're serving it to company.
Right? Yes, this is true.
Yeah, it looks like hell, really. Now, I mentioned a few, you know, arugula, radishes, mustards. Like, I might just direct sow them as a home gardener, you know, in my raised beds or whatever, a short row of each one frequently. But, you know, I think you do a lot of transplanting of starts sown in the greenhouse, and I do that with other things in my house under
mm-hmm.
lights or whatever. Do you sort of lump together certain brassicas into groups of, like, when you start them and how you start them and how long they're indoors and when they go out? Or it's not is each one distinctive, or are there some groups we could talk about?
Well, yeah. In terms of the above-ground crops, we'll leave out the root crops like rutabaga
yeah.
and radish for a moment. I lump them into salad crops, like you mentioned, arugula,
okay.
the mustard,
okay.
Brassica rob, things that you would, you know, cut repeatedly for salads and
mm-hmm.
such, as opposed to the crops that are where you're getting more of a head, you know, like broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, kohlrabi.
Oh, okay.
So those two categories would be, you know, the salad crops would be the direct sown ones, and those heading types would be what I grow transplants of.
Okay.
And, you know, something like a broccoli, if you're not getting a head, there's not much value to the crop. Whereas an arugula plant, if it doesn't get huge, you're still able to get some leaves off of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I see the extra effort behind making transplants and babying them indoors, however you do it, under lights or in a greenhouse or a cold frame, is worth the effort.
So,
because you
yeah.
want to get, you know, you want to get a crop.
Right. So do you back up like a month or 6 weeks for indoor time with those? Or what's your sort of formula-ish in terms of timing and length of time indoors?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're not using artificial lights of
right.
any sort. So, you know, coming up soon in Oregon, February 1st is when we're going to do our first seeding of broccoli and cauliflower
mm-hmm.
and so forth. So you can think the day length is shorter. If you're seeding, let's say, April 1st, they'll grow more quickly, and
yes.
you could have transplants ready in a month. I would say from our February 1st planting, it's not going to be until 6 to 8 weeks after that we'll actually
okay.
be transplanting those out.
Okay.
And that's where I think this is an important thing to consider, is because the brassica family is a fairly nutrient-intensive crop that wants a lot of nitrogen so it can grow quick. I've found if you don't have adequate nutrition, the plant gets stunted and it can just never really thrive.
Oh boy, if
so
I had
broccoli,
that experience, Don.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had that in a couple beds
yeah,
where I didn't know.
As,
yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, it's tiny heads or just
yep.
It's a very unfulfilling gardening experience.
Yeah.
So by supplying adequate nutrition in the form of, we really just use compost, but
mm-hmm.
we may do some kind of foliar spray with fish emulsion or kelp or something
mm-hmm.
to help nurture them along. And also in terms of if you're doing starts indoors, making sure you're giving the plant enough room for its roots. And a rule of thumb that we use is each cubic inch of soil is enough fertility for 1 month.
Oh, okay.
So if the plant is in there longer than a month, you need to begin to augment that.
Okay.
With either some kind of liquid fertility.
Okay.
So fish emulsion works great for that.
Okay. So like in my climate where frost-free date is maybe more like mid-May or third week of May, something like that, and I think I can put these cool season guys, like you were just speaking about cauliflower or broccoli, I think of putting them out maybe 2-3 weeks maybe before the frost date, maybe even a little
mm-hmm.
earlier, maybe 4 weeks. I don't know. I might start them 4 or 6 weeks inside. You know, that's my sort of like
yeah.
rough. So it's the same thing, but in a different part of the country, you have a greenhouse, natural light. I'm doing them under higher light in a warmer environment as if it's later,
mm-hmm.
so to speak. You know, so, but the formula works out either way, I think, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, for us, for broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, that clan, if you will,
mm-hmm.
my favorite, if I'm thinking about it from my home garden perspective of really wanting to get food out of it, my favorite size pots to use for starting them are actually fairly large. They're about 2 inches square
oh.
and about 3 inches deep.
Okay.
So you can think, you know, then you get a really healthy, large transplant. So when you put it out, the plant can afford to lose a couple leaves to pests or slugs or what have you.
Oh.
And as opposed to, you know, smaller starts where if it loses a little bit, it's going to be really stressed.
Well, and sometimes you see them in sell in traditional 6 or 4 packs in the nursery, and they've already started to sort of stretch. They look spindly. You know what I mean? They've lost their lower
mm-hmm.
leaves, and it's like, oh, boy, that guy's not happy. You know, and so you're saying it would have liked having double the amount of soil volume, you know, and
exactly.
nutrition. Yeah. Okay, good, 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 good.
Yeah.
So not so many people that I know grow collards as they do kale. Do you find that out there, too? Is it more kale than collards?
Yes, I do. But we've been growing some seed for a company that's in Virginia called Southern Exposure Seeds.
Oh, and I love them for many years. Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they've really opened my eyes to the incredible diversity of different types of collards.
Yes.
And there's one particular type that we just started offering through our seed company called Cascade Glaze that was actually bred by Carol Deppe, who's a Oregon plant breeder here.
Yes, we've had her on
and
the show. She's great, sure.
Yeah. So instead of that blue-green waxy look,
mm-hmm.
this actually has a shiny light green color to it. And I guess in the Southeast they call them greasy collards.
They still call everything greasy there, don't they? Greasy beans and greasy. It's so funny.
I mean, maybe that has to do with your cooking technique.
The fat back.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
But from what I understand, and I've never really done side-by-side trials of how kale holds up over the heat of the summer versus collards, but from what I gather, collards are more of a heat-adapted way to have greens through the summer, whereas I know for us out here in Oregon, when we can get up in the upper 90s or even over 100 come July or August, that really brings aphids to our kale. The plant seems to still grow and be fine with it, but it means a lot of washing when you want to prepare it as food. And collards tend to have less of the savoy, the wrinkliness to the leaves, so there's less places for the aphids to hide. It's more of a flat leaf, so even if they do get some aphids, it's easier to wash them off.
You even have this tree collard, which is sort of a different beast altogether, which was kind of hilarious in the catalog I saw. That you sell is like transplants. You sell plants of that, yes? Not seeds.
Actually, cuttings.
Cuttings, okay. Oh, cuttings, yeah.
Yeah. Huh. And one of my mentors, Doug Gosling, who he's managed the gardens at the Occidental Center for Arts and Ecology for 30 years, he exposed me to this. And they had one plant that was, I would say, 8 feet in diameter, where the stems would grow up and bend and fall over and re-root farther out, and it just was this old jungle of collards. So I took some cuttings from that years ago, and basically it's just stems that are about the diameter of your thumb, and you put them in a gallon pot of soil, and they grow roots, and it just becomes this... I don't know if it would work in the Northeast where it gets really cold, but for us, we're in zone 7, and then really only gets down to about 20 degrees Fahrenheit in the winter.
Yeah.
And they're just unstoppable, really.
Yeah, fascinating. I'm going to have to learn more. I'm going to look up more about the plant. But we have to make time to delve into Brussels sprouts, because of the ones we've talked about so far, I see some listings in the different catalogs, it'll say this is a mid-season one, or this is for late fall harvest, or this is an early one. Mm-hmm. And I see maturity dates from 100 days, 110 days. I've even seen the ones that supposedly overwinter, like I think you can in some parts of the country in the Northwest can overwinter them, 200 something days, all kinds of different numbers. I'm kind of like, what am I trying to do, and how do I time it so that I can have Brussels sprouts more than 1 minute, in the garden if I'm lucky, right? So let's tell us, help me with those.
Yeah, well, first, just to address the days to maturity point. As a seedsman, I kind of wish we would do away with those numbers, because it really depends on when you plant it, how well you take care of it, how your climate is, and so forth. So for a broccoli, for instance, it may be advertised as a 70-day broccoli, but that's really from transplant. So you may have 6 weeks indoors, and then you transplant it, and then 70 days later you have it. So, again, those Brussels sprouts, I find that for us in Oregon, you grow them as a spring crop. They go over the summer, and they're a full-sized plant that's developing Brussels sprouts around the fall equinox.
Yes.
And then you're able to start cutting it sometime after Halloween.
Okay.
And they'll hold in the field.
Mm-hmm.
So as opposed to like a fall cabbage or fall cauliflower, where you'd actually be seeding that in the midsummer.
Right.
In order to grow the plant up, Brussels sprouts, the one I view it as a 120-day crop. So that's 4 months.
Yeah.
And if you don't get it going in the spring, like if you try and plant it as a fall crop, it'll look like a collard. It won't ever make Brussels sprouts, or you'll have really small ones the size of a dime.
I've seen that too.
Yeah.
And sometimes I have great ones and sometimes not so. And I always thought, well, what am I doing wrong? So you're saying that we started early, but we're expecting to be there for the long haul. So we probably need to take really good care of this plant and probably give it a good spot where we can't neglect it, right? I mean, it's got to have good nutrition probably too, and so forth, because it's going to try to create all those sprouts. I mean, it's a lot of work, it seems like.
Yeah, and I think, with a lot of these brassicas, it's worth taking a step back and just considering they all evolved around the Mediterranean Sea.
Okay.
And you could imagine they were plants that they made seed, how they started as their wild ancestor, sometime in the summer with the warm Mediterranean sun. They drop that seed, and then as the fall rains would come, they would sprout and grow through the winter, through the spring, and then complete their life cycle like that. So it was very daylight dependent.
Uh-huh.
So you can think, you know, here in the northern latitudes, come September, the days are getting much shorter, you know, equal day and night, really. So if you haven't sized the plant up before then, there's just no way there's enough sunlight, no matter how much water and fertility you give it. So that's a really important consideration, is that we're having to use biennial brassicas. You need to have the way that we cultivate it coincide with its ancestral life cycle.
I see.
And, you know, I think just a little meditation on the Mediterranean climate, no matter where you are growing, will reveal how to help that plant thrive the best.
That's a completely different way to think about it. That's good. I like that. Do you harvest with the Brussels sprouts? Do you top them at some point? You know, I've read, oh, well, you're supposed to have topped the plant, Margaret. Or do you know what I mean? Like tactics to get it to sprout up, so to speak, make the sprouts?
Yeah, I've never done that.
Me neither.
I will go through. And I've noticed diseases and pests will kind of attack the lower leaves.
Mm-hmm.
So I will strip off those leaves in the fall. As I'm, you know, a lot of it's just kind of like taking a moment to see, like, hey, what's going on over here? Let's get all these dead leaves off the plant and see, you know, what's happening. Because you'll see the little buds where the sprouts will be developing, because they basically form on those leaf scars as the plant grows up the stalk. You know, so it starts off low
yes.
to the ground as a mound of leaves, and then it elongates. And that elongation really is taking place between the summer solstice and the fall equinox. So again, just thinking about that life cycle, it's responding to the shortening of the day length.
Mm-hmm.
I don't top it because I think, like, well, Brussels sprouts, again, we're eating them for the nutrition, and they've got to have some leaves, and if they don't have any leaves down low, where are they, how are they doing what they do?
Right.
But also thinking about all those leaves that it has to make, just making sure that it has plenty of compost. So if you have limited compost availability, you might want to portion more of it for your Brussels sprouts than other things, or side dress
yes.
would be an appropriate thing. We do that with celery as well. Just some crops just have higher nutritional needs, and if you really want to be successful, that's how to approach it.
So mid growing season, you're side dressing, you're adding some more compost to the sides of the rows, or are you doing that right when
exactly.
you're planting? Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah, we'll just go through with a shovel and kind of sift it along the sides,
okay.
and then sometimes even hoe. We'll do that before we weed, and then the hoeing action will kind of
okay.
incorporate the right. compost into that top
all
layer
right.
of soil.
Well, before we run out of time, I've got to ask you, because I promised it at the introduction, what do you do? Do you have sort of garden sanitation processes or other tactics for cabbage worms? We have here in the Northeast, we have both the imported cabbage worm, the green one, and the cross-striped, sort of bluish, strange-looking one, purpley-gray.
Yeah.
Anything we can do tactically when we're thinking about growing these brassicas this coming spring, you know, to sort of thwart that, or in garden sanitation?
Well, one thing that I've gained a lot of value from in my life is thinking about a concept that my friend Dr. Lindsay Dutoy, who's a plant pathologist in Washington, shared with me, of the green bridge, of thinking that these pests, you know, they have a life cycle. In order for them to be present, they have to have something to live on year-round.
Yes.
So if you always have brassicas in your garden, then the pests can go from one plant to another to the next forever. So breaking that cycle, so instead of just letting the brassicas you're done with rot where they are, of pulling
yes.
them up and putting them in the compost, so that you keep, you know, sanitation that way.
Okay.
I don't think you need to be excessive about it, but I have found that they want to find, it's kind of like lily pads, if you will,
mm-hmm.
that they need to hop from one
mm-hmm.
to the next.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed, too, that they tend to be worse in some years than others, and
here
I'm not
too.
Entirely sure why that is, but also think that the cabbage worms are a very soft, juicy morsel for a meal for some other insect or birds or
yeah.
you know, something else. So thinking about the habitat in your garden, you know, are there beneficial insect attracting plants, or people use the term beetle banks
yeah.
or all sorts of things, like rose beetles will eat slugs and cabbage worms and other caterpillars.
I have to get me some of those. So we're out of time, but I'm going to ask you before the show runs to give me a list of some new things in the Siskiyou offerings. We're going to have a little sidebar kind of box to go with the transcript of the show. I'm so glad to talk to you, Don, again, and thank you for reading my mind, as I said at the beginning. Always welcome when you do so.
Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/AwayToGarden. Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books and gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
And I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon, too, I hope. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. Find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or facebook.com/awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.